I'll give a little bit of my love to you. There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care. I'll give a little bit of my life for you. So give a little bit.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Let's jump in a time machine for a moment and go to the year 2030. Why? Because we're going to take a look at nanotime in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with our guest, Bart Kosko. Bart, let's move on to 2030 for a moment. What's happening in that time period to all of us?
That's a great question. There's been a lot of work on extrapolating oil, on computer chips that we talked about. How far out in the future can we look on those fronts? And the year 2030, a lot of the experts see great problems with our current oil consumption, with the effects of computer chips going the way that they go. So it's my prediction, George, in the fact-based novel Nanotime, that around that time you potentially could have a World War III. I was intrigued by what a World War III would look like, and I want to tell you something now on the air that I've never mentioned in the many press interviews I've done about Nanotime. The years have passed since its genesis, but how that book came to be. I was fishing in the Sierras, and when classes were out about this time, and came back and had a voicemail, my voicemail machine, from the film director Oliver Stone, and who I know through other channels.
Sure.
And Oliver was interested in coming up with a movie that would compete with Stanley Kubrick's then movie, AI. Of course, it came out later by Steven Spielberg, produced by Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
And Oliver said, take a shot at it. Give me something. You're my machine intelligence friend. Give me something big. So I went back fishing, and I thought about that, and I thought, well, the biggest event in the 20th century, this was towards the end of the 20th century, was World War II, and arguably that was the biggest event in history. And the big event in the next century will likely be a World War III. And then I began the research of what that might look like in terms of how far we could plausibly extrapolate. And I haven't seen much from the CIA to Israeli intelligence and many other folks that could go beyond the year 2030. And in particular, I wanted to explore the concept that I've been looking at for years and based on my earlier years in the defense industry of what I call a smart war, where we release our smart weapons against theirs, and what that kind of thing would look like in a highly globalized multimedia world of the near future. And that's the novel Nanotime, or the premise behind it. A time when oil as the energy of choice, source of choice, is running out. There's about 1 trillion barrels left now, depending on how you count them, and we're burning well beyond 25 billion barrels a year. And it isn't clear whether we'll shift to hydrogen directly or come up with synthetic nano-based fossil fuel type devices, nano-alkanes. A lot of people are looking at that. But it does suggest, George, that the power structure in the Middle East will change, where the great bulk of the easy access oil still lies, really under the Arabian Peninsula. And for example, if you just transitioned from oil to water, for example, in a hydrogen economy, think of the turbulence that would cause in that hotbed of political activity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't think it's that far-fetched. It's certainly a speculative hypothesis. And we'll never, I want to make clear, we're never going to run out of oil. It's just at some point it will not be as economically viable as alternatives.
To pull it out. I've always believed, Bart, not to change your pattern here, but I'm not so sure oil is a fossil fuel. I'm beginning to wonder if it's a part of the planet. It seems to be regenerating itself in certain areas around this planet. It's just weird. This whole thing is weird. I like you, don't think we're going to run out. I'm just wondering now if we have enough to sustain ourselves for 100,000 years. I hope we get away from it, quite honestly. But I'm beginning to think that maybe it was part of the formation of the planet. Did you ever think about that?
Yeah, I think there's pretty good evidence, George, that it comes from decaying carbon matter, organic matter. And we're talking about, in the chemist terms, alkanes here, octane, for example, that sort of thing. So I think the first order, we can work with a hydrocarbon model. And even if we didn't run out, as we burn more of this, we really do have a kind of market failure effect here, where we impose third-party costs, not just on each other, but really on the whole environment. Obviously, global warming is one example of that, but a variety of other types of pollution. And it's not at all clear if that's a serious problem, as many people think, or if it is, how one would address that. But those third-party costs, even if you had plenty of oil, are a big enough concern, I think, to lead to alternatives. But I think there's no great consensus that we could have another 100 years like we've had with oil, that we're looking more like 20 or 30, if even that, in terms of the current structure of the economy. And when that changes, the whole power structure of the global economy, the global political structure, I think will change as well. And it's not at all clear. A little country, for example, like Israel, which has no oil but has great intellectual assets, wonderful scientific institutes, it's doing great research in these subjects. It may find itself, in effect, in the position of Saudi Arabia in terms of that new economy. And that has great potential for conflict. And the other concern here, George, as we all know, especially since 9/11, is that the Muslim religion is, Islam is the fastest growing religion, and it has that radical element in it. It's obviously not the whole religion, but we're talking a billion people here. And so even a small percentage of that who condone or participate in suicide bombings, that sort of thing, are a real problem. And you combine that with the faster, cheaper, better weapons becoming available, you get a point of concern. If I can just call something to your attention, I saw recently on CNN, it was one of those little throwaway moments that got very little attention, but it was some video footage someone took, I believe right at near, not Tel Aviv, but in northern Israel. And what it was a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle, from the terrorist group Hezbollah. Now you think about that for a minute. This was a small drone,
yes,
apparently it was the second time it's been done,
exactly.
Flown right over Israeli civilian centers that could have been crashed at will, really wherever they want.
That's true.
And that is a kind of a cruise missile, and the very premise behind the novel Nanotime, World War III, that the cruise missile is the weapon of choice in a smart war, very much as now a nanotube is the device of choice in nanotechnology. That may change in the future. And it's something that flies low. It's almost impossible to shoot down. It's often described as trying to hit a bullet with a bullet. And the cost just keeps falling. And we sell these to Britain, and only to Britain so far, at about $1 million per pop. But they really cost about a tenth of that, about $100,000. And as a practical matter, you can make an improvised device probably more on the order of $10,000. And that will only increase. And it isn't that far away, George, when really every country and terrorist organization may have stockpiles of these things.
Well, I know, and that's scary.
Right, and here we get a new principle, that in a smart war, unlike the traditional wars of the past, which have been based on atoms rather than bits, here it becomes cheaper to attack than to defend. It's always been more difficult to attack than defend in the past. It took 1,000 ships to invade Troy, for example. It's a very expensive thing to set up a siege, but it's trivial, comparatively, to attack with an information device. And computer viruses are another example of that principle at work. And as we know, those are only increasing. But much beyond that, the ability to launch something that you can't do much about, it can do surveillance, pinpoint strikes. I mean, if you think about it, 9/11 was really an improvised cruise missile attack, a commandeering of an airliner with lots of fuel on board, but it acted very much like a low-flying, hard-to-hit, you could have hit that in that case, but a hard-to-hit cruise missile.
Well, a low-tech version, I would guess, huh?
A very low-tech version, but it also showed the power of that and the difficulty. You could have an immense trillion-dollar Star Wars shield up in the sky, and that's the roof. You can still defeat that by coming in through the sides here. And so the world of nanotime, and I'll explain the title in a moment, but the world of nanotime, George, is a world where we're shifting from oil to something like hydrogen. The balance of power is changing throughout the global economy, but in particular in the Middle East. And weapons, smart weapons, are so smart, where 1 second of CPU time, say in the year 2030, would be comparable to all the computers running in, say, the year, or a fair chunk of the time, the year 2000. Unimaginable increases in bit-based efficiency, thanks to Moore's Law that we talked about. And the ease with which you can have one group, not just countries, but one group attacking others, and the continued spread of radical Islam.
Do you see the use of soldiers in 2030?
Well, I think we'll still have soldiers, but you know, the nature of battles is to exploit the opponent's weakness. And so if your opponent is the United States and it's got the superior conventional forces, then you've got to appeal to non-conventional tactics. For example, 9/11, crashing an improvised cruise missile, for example, in the Pentagon or World Trade Center. There'll always be soldiers. But the ability to launch, obviously, a nano device, if you could make it, but just short of that, just taking standard chemical explosives put on aerial platforms and great stockpiles of those, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of those launched from, say, suppose, for example, Egypt caves into radical Muslims, which is a real possibility. For example, if Egypt decided to go pro-democracy tomorrow and have a vote, that's exactly who would take power. And it's not too far-fetched to imagine a world where there was yet another attack on the state of Israel. And I say that because, although the government of Israel doesn't acknowledge it officially, the estimates are that Israel has 200 to 300 ballistic nuclear missiles. And this is the real reason why that country still exists, because it has the power to incinerate every Muslim capital within a very large radius of Tel Aviv.
Well, and you really don't even need 200 to do what you have to do.
That's right. And, of course, as a consequence, we have countries like Iran, which have plenty of oil, no need for nuclear power, busying themselves to come up with what appears to be nuclear weapons. And you don't even need those again. Conventional warheads on cruise missile-type devices would be enough to swamp, say, Israel. Then you get a retaliatory strike, a doomsday strike from Israel. Somebody pushes that button, and 200 nuclear ballistic missiles come out. And that, I think, is the basis of a scenario for World War III. And that's ignoring the
effects
in China.
Which could happen, Bart. That could very well happen.
I think, George, if certain elements grab control of the Saudi Empire, I mean, the House of Fahd is a dictatorship, a monarchy, as are so many countries in that part of the world, and they're unstable. And at some point, they'll probably fall. And likewise, Egypt. The Sudan is somewhat under Muslim control now, radical Muslim control. But that's, I think, entirely possible. Or it could just be commandeering a few of the attack weapons in one of these countries. But the neat thing from a strategic point of view, from a game theoretic point of view, as we say, is the retaliatory capability of the state of Israel. Again, it's usually kept fairly quiet, but it's not that quiet. And you can go to the net and look at Jane's and other military analyst sources and see the estimates of the number of ballistic nuclear weapons stashed in the hills, the Judean hills. And if it weren't for that, again, as a few brave Israeli souls have said, if it weren't for that, the opposition to Israel would probably drive the Jews into the sea, as it's often put.
Well, unfortunately, if there's that kind of a magnitude of an attack, it's going to be a suicide mission for everybody out there.
Yeah, and for you and I, that's sufficient
deterrent. Nobody wins. Nobody wins.
Right, but for people who are willing to kill themselves or to send their children on suicide missions, I don't think that's a deterrent at all. And especially with an easy promise of rewards in an afterlife, George, this is a problem. We talked about God earlier, but in the classical religions, I have argued, and you can see the op-eds on the webpage, one long-term argument against religion is that it does have an easy promise of an afterlife. The Western religions have put a prohibition on suicide to keep you from trying to go too quickly to the afterlife. And one unintended consequence of that, that's a form of insurance of sorts, and I think it's kept us from really squarely facing death and trying in a good engineering way to conquer death, which I think in time we will do, likely not in our lifetime, but at some point in the future. But again, in terms of deterrence, if you believe in a shortcut to paradise and you're willing to kill yourself and those around you, I don't think they would be worried about the retaliatory strike. It's just their access to the weapons that matters.
But regardless of what kind of technology you get in the future, eventually some wacko is going to do something. And you can't stop it. Yeah, it is a given, and you can't stop it. It's almost as if we are doomed.
I think we're doomed in the sense we're going to get those kind of incidental hits, and we do what we can to protect against it, George. And we're obviously most concerned now, quite legitimately, on a nuclear attack or even a dirty bomb attack because of the psychological and economic effects. But as we transition to the global economy of the future, the truly global economy, where information is so much more powerful than it is today and cheap, and weapons are easy to make, there's nothing we can really do about them. If you think for a moment about the Iraqi insurgency, it's largely with very old-fashioned weapons and improvised explosive devices that you get the counterinsurgency, you get the insurgency. This is the issue. Also, at nanotime is a little more fanciful, but that's about the time, George, when, well after the time, when computer chips are vastly more powerful than the human brain. And if you could put the chip in the brain, you mentioned before the break, this is being done now for medical purposes, but put that chip in the brain and ultimately have a kind of assassin that way, or a large number of such assassins. And if you were to be on the time of a chip rather than on the time of neurons, which we're on now, things would be much faster. So in a minute of our time, you would have tens of years or thousands of years, depending on how fast those chips are, and I call that nanotime. And there's an interplay in the book between our regular wet time or neural network time or brain-based time versus those who start to make that transition, to who break through to the other side, as Jim Morrison said, and go to nanotime.
Do you think if there are advanced civilizations out there in the universe that they have gone through this process that we're going through now, this incredible process of possibly destroying the planet, destroying people, do they get through it? Obviously, somehow, some of them probably did. But I'm wondering if they all go through this same kind of horrible evolution to get there.
I would think they'd have to. They would have to go from the first 92 elements in the periodic table, the naturally occurring elements, the atoms, to bits. And when you do that, you get these terrible or wonderful efficiencies that we've been talking about, this great transition from atoms to bits. And it's not clear what those life forms or intelligences would look like. But I think that's a given, George, that they would have made that. Whether we would expect to see the silvery suits of Star Trek and just lumbering bodies at all, I think I find that quite fanciful. But I think you're right. They would have had to survive, otherwise we wouldn't see them in the maybe intergalactic Darwinian competition that would emerge. But they would have gotten beyond the periodic table. They will have conquered matter. It moved into information. We know at least that much of science, and of course, they would like to know a great deal more.
Let's when we come back, Bart, I want to talk with you about some current applications of this kind of technology, and what this all means. And then somehow, by the end of this hour, it's all going to come back to that first question that we talked about, and that is, of course, the deliberate use of things that God may or may not be doing, because I think that is going to be the major factor in whether we all continue or not. I think we're going to have to decide pretty soon whether technology is going to be used for good or for bad. And I don't know which way we'll go. Do you?
I wish I did. Like all good questions, George, I think you can actually argue those on both sides, and we simply don't have the evidence now.
No, we don't. You know, a long time ago, and in high school, I had written a paper report on which said that basically eventually we would need as a nation to go one of two ways. That would be to let every nation advance and grow technologically and risk our own annihilation in the process, or you completely try to keep them in the dark ages militarily. And those are two questions we're going to have to face pretty soon, because if we go in, for example, to Iran and take out their nuclear capabilities, you got to do it all the time. You know, every 10 years, let's say, when they get to that point, you have to make a decision. This is going to go on forever. It'll never stop.
Yeah, you move from gun control to global weapons control, and I think it would be just as effective as gun control. That is, it wouldn't work at all.
Absolutely. So when we come back, let's talk about some new products that nanotechnology could help us. Let's talk about some help when we come back. If you need to email me, That's very simple. It's George at coasttocoastam.com. Our website is coasttocoastam.com. Bart Costco's website, way too long with too many slashes and dashes, but it's very simple. It's right there linked up with his name at coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
I'm going to open up the Fast Blasts, those of you who might have Fast Blast questions for Bart Costco, and the next hour I'll open up the phone lines, and we'll do the same thing. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Bart Costco. Bart, what are the new products coming down in the very foreseeable future that will change us beyond the chips that we've talked about?
So, George, there are golf balls and tennis balls and maybe modifying the graphite and a racket. These are kind of humdrum nanotechnology products, but they're real, and they come in from many angles. There's an effort out of Samsung to give us better flat panel displays so that they're, of course, cheaper, but you can take them out in the sun and have a better vision of them. They're not as hot. They can do more internally. It's a variety of gadgets, and something that I've worked on at the theoretical level with a PhD student who's now got his PhD, Dr. Ian Lee. We looked at the problem of body armor and just the effect on clothing, and I mentioned you can go to Eddie Bauer and get a pair of nano pants or other, in effect, Teflon and woven shirts or devices where the water beads right off. But what about if you could shoot soft body armor and disperse a lot of that energy without producing horrific bruising, which takes place? In fact, if viewers or listeners, rather, go to my webpage and download the preprint of the journal article on vest technology, you'll see a policeman who was shot wearing a bulletproof vest, shot by a .44 Magnum, and the horrific bruising that takes place, and worse, the skin trauma beneath that. There's been a lot of work, George, at several laboratories, often sponsored by the Army, as you would imagine, on this issue. And can we find a way to get, at that nano level, the fibers or nano stuff woven into the fibers, to including nanotubes, to at the key moment come together, maybe transform their chemical properties somewhat, or to somehow disperse the energy. And that seems to be the case. So even taking simple carbon nanotubes and putting them in Zylon or Kevlar fabric seems to greatly increase that. And there's something called shear thickening fluid, stuff that's fluid-like. So you might have a fluid-based vest, but when you're shot at that moment or hit with a sudden impact, it suddenly becomes quite rigid and recruits fibers in effect, or takes on a woven-type structure, or simulates that in that nearby area. Then after the energy's been dispersed, it goes back to something else. That's at the military level. Of course, that's a life and death thing if you're in Iraq or if you're a police officer in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, George, there's a great effort to put the sheer computational power into clothing. For example, it wouldn't be a bad idea maybe to have some nano sensors woven in your shirt. This is quite feasible. So, for example, maybe it changes color to detect a certain virus or any kind of biological agent. There's a lot of people working on that. There's the Office of Homeland Security is supporting literally billions of dollars of research one way or another directed at that. And it's not the sort of thing you can pull off the rack right now, but it is an active development.
What are the Chinese doing in this field?
You know, the Chinese are, if you go to the web pages of the journal Nanotechnology or the journal Nano Letters, and you can go to both of those, and just look at the co-authors' names, you'll see an awful lot of Chinese names. This is a big deal for the Chinese. They've really found, I think, a niche in the sciences. Even though, for example, carbon nanotubes were discovered by a Japanese researcher in the early 1990s, and the Japanese have dominated consumer electronics and things like fuzzy logic. But at the device level, where chemistry intersects electrical engineering and information sciences, the Chinese are doing wonders here. Chinese researchers in general, and the Chinese, as you know, graduate more science and engineering PhDs than we do. Now, as a U.S. professor, I'd argue that ours are better, but you have to be realistic. And India is coming right up in the pipeline as well. In fact, if you walked around at USC to my school, at our graduate school, we were just ranked 7th in the nation by U.S. News and World Report, you would see a lot more Chinese and Indian faces than typical Americans.
Well, that's absolutely true. Like you say, it doesn't make them any more advanced, but per capita, they're throwing out more than we are.
Right, and other countries, not just India and China, but other countries are actively pursuing all aspects here, not just simple gadgets like putting nanotubes and nanodevices and nanowires and fibers or in golf clubs, and understands another application, but also at the pure bio level. And this is an issue you touched on before the break. If we tie our hands, George, on issues of cloning and a lot of things like that, we, in effect, just surrender a technological advantage to countries that don't do that, for example, Japan or China or a variety of other countries. And we have to come to grips with that. And also, if you look at the number of patents, if you go to the PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, you'll see there's a great number of those from foreign countries. And that's only on the increase. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but if the United States has to make a collective decision here of sorts, it is one ultimately involving education and perhaps funding and a variety of other things. We've had it very good since World War II in this country. We've had the technological lead. We weren't really challenged. You simply can't argue that for the next 20 years, and certainly not the next 50.
Times are changing, aren't they?
They sure are.
John from Bristol, Tennessee, wants to know if our economy will change in the future because of all of this.
It certainly will. I mean, for example, right now, oil keeps hovering between $40 and $50 a barrel, despite the incredible efficiencies we have now taking oil out of the ground. But that still is a key input, a cost factor in almost every aspect of production. So, of course, it will increase. Moore's Law has been tied to an overall boost in worldwide global economies. That should continue. When we really push through, George, to the nano chip, not looking ahead to the really speculative nano applications, but when we go from microprocessor to nanoprocessor, when Microsoft changes its name and trademark it into NanoSoft, when that day comes, I think you'll likely see a concomitant exponential effect in the economy. There was something called a paradox of efficiency. There were years and years of exponential investment in computer devices in this country with only linear increases in productivity. And then we started to see in the 1990s, with the advent of the Internet, something closer, not an exponential increase, but a faster rate of growth. And I think that's through our lives, provided we don't get hit by an asteroid or blow ourselves up, I think we can count on an ever-expanding global economy and all the pros and cons that come with that.
Of course, those two possibilities you just mentioned are pretty highly possible.
It can happen at any time, and it's happened in the past. But I'd be much more worried about the damage we do to ourselves here, intentional and unintentional, than the asteroid. But we do have to take it seriously.
The story today, they said that our air is getting cleaner, but that, too, could be a cause of global warming because now more sunlight's coming through. We can't win. You can't win.
I heard a proposal, by the way, in terms of the asteroid. It was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, I believe. I thought it was worth doing. It was a simple appeal to humanity to go back to the moon, George, and to set up not a big moon colony. We'll do that in time anyway. But to simply put up there all of our books and libraries, a kind of Asimov foundation, just in case we get hit by an asteroid, as a kind of backup, a global backup. And that seems to me something the great powers of the Earth could agree upon.
That's interesting, kind of to preserve the history of mankind.
We would hate to start all over and have to figure out calculus again.
Well, you know what? I've always wondered what would happen if something happened to this planet. And, you know, I'm good at certain things. I'm horrible at other things. But what happens if, for example, all our scientists died or all our people who are experts at fixing cars died and we still had cars here? I mean, if we lost segments of civilizations because of the catastrophe, we'd be out. I mean, how would you take care of it, for example, if all our scientists who knew how to build rocket engines all died? We'd never be able to get, it would be years before we could do that again.
It could well be. And I think it's worth remembering that if we took any of us and backed up in time and plopped us back 50,000 years ago, we would have a very short, nasty, and brutish existence. And the only real difference between then and now is technology. And so if something happens to that technological base, who knows what it could be? We may not go back to those years of complete primitive state, but it would take a long time to get back just to where we are. But I think the idea of going to the moon, for example, and depositing a lot of CDs or whatever else is a good one. It's something that we could all agree on. It's not an ideological issue. It's not a partisan issue. It's just a simple common sense thing of having a collective backup. The thing we don't have, for example, for our own brains yet.
Yeah, but what happens if we send it, we need it? Well, how are we going to get there?
It may be a replay. I mentioned Stanley Kubrick before in the effort that we tried to make a movie out of nanotime. By the way, we tried like hell to get it funded, but there weren't the computer graphics facilities at the time. But it may be like that, that it's a kind of IQ test for the civilization until they get back to the moon and find it. But it'd still be nice to have it up there. I think it'd be a goal for us to shoot for, just to give us a kind of backup in face of unlikely but unforeseen tragedy.
What do you think old Albert Einstein would be saying about the advance of our technology today? Do you think he envisioned this?
No. I think it would be very hard. In that age in which he was born, even though he was a patent clerk, and he was about as smart as any human being ever was, but it's very difficult. I mean, I think you would in that era have been thinking about speeding up the horses and buggies in effect, but I think it must have been a shock for him later in life just to have a sense of the commercial airline economy that we have and where we are now. If you go back, George, and look at the good old science fiction from the 1940s, what's often called the golden era, the thing that's missing there, these are great minds writing, the thing that's missing is computers. It's just, if it's there, they're, you know, big, monstrous machines. But the idea of that chip and the power of it and those transistors is something they missed. And, for example, we mentioned Moore's Law. And Gordon Moore recently estimated the number of transistors that are actually shipped by companies per year. And in the year 2003, the last year for which we have data, he said it's on the order of 10 quintillion. More transistors, George, than grains of rice on the planet. More transistors by a factor of 100 than ants on the planet.
That is something.
And many more yet to come. And so I think the great minds of the past missed that completely. In the same way, if you read Brave New World, not only do you Nazi computers in there, there's no mention of nuclear weapons. It's something that Huxley simply couldn't foresee.
When you can barely see a nano tube, for example,
can't see it at all.
How do they make it if you can't even see it?
You could make it by getting certain gases cooked up, in effect, in an oven and sparking it and creating soot. I mean, technically, whenever you build a fire, as the primitive man did, nanotubes were forming in the soot. Of course, he didn't know that, and you couldn't. You'd need an atomic force microscope to do something with them.
Sure.
But there are a variety of devices that do that, but the most common are some kind of a vaporization with, if you would like, lightning striking in there and getting nanotubes as a fallout.
Can they control what they're making?
Absolutely. It makes a big difference. And
man, it's
it
way
matters.
Beyond me.
The weave can matter. The length of a nanotube can matter. For example, one of the devices that I looked at with young Dr. Ian Lee, my PhD student, is an artificial ear implant, an artificial cochlea. Your ear, inner ear, has little cilia hairs that detect frequencies, and they get transmitted to the brain, and you have the sense or the illusion of sound. And as you age or listen to too much loud music, those bend or break. But in theory, we can replace those with nanotubes, each one sitting there waiting for a specific frequency to arrive. And one of the nice things about tubes, George, is just their length can affect their frequency. So by modulating the length of the tube, we can program the frequencies. By modulating and changing the chemical bath of some of the tubes, we can program them that way. By changing the twist in the weave, you can affect their metallic structure, or make them semi-metallic. It's really quite wonderful, the ability to program matter at that level.
WK, listening to us right now in Paris, France, says no two countries could even agree on what to put on the moon. No two books of history, it would be impossible for
well, how about this then?
To chip in.
I think that's, if that were the, if we try to make it a collective decision, he's absolutely right. But if let each country have their own depository,
that's a good point. Let them do their own thing. Simple as that. Are you excited about the future, or are you concerned?
Very excited, George. We all would like to be younger, but I wish I were born later. I really hate the idea I'm going to miss what's coming. And I am a cryonicist, and that's about the only way. It's not a great way, but it's a crude way, and it's not a cost-trivial way. But it's one of the only real way that I'm aware of that you have some slight chance of coming back and seeing it very likely reconstructed in a chip or some type of structure. What I'd like to live to see, George, we all would, is the era when we can back up our brains at low cost and then maybe have a chip implant or transfer to it completely, the so-called upload. I'm not sure we're going to see that. The chips are getting powerful, but this porting technology, which a lot of people are working on, including my colleagues at USC, Ted Berger and many others, that's a big bottleneck. And so if you're not sure you're going to make it to the age of uploads, the only alternative right now, in a scientific sense, is instead of burying or burning those synapses that make up your brain, is freezing them in liquid nitrogen.
What do you think about a space elevator being built with nanotubes?
I think it's a possibility. The nano wires and the fibers that you could weave from it, that's certainly possible. It takes a lot of energy, though, to raise something up, and there have been a variety of proposals for that. And, of course, there's a concern of running into the thing, hitting it with aircraft or space debris or birds or whatever it happens to be. But I think we could surmount that. I think it would make a great international project, much more effective, say, than the space station.
Tom wants to know if you would elaborate a little bit more on your noise experiments.
Happy to do that. The concept here is called stochastic resonance. It just means noise can sometimes help. Too much noise is almost always bad, but a little bit of noise is good. For example, my colleague Jim Collins at Boston University has shown if you take about 1 milliamp electricity and shock your fingertips, that increases your ability to detect things in a tactile sense and can help blind people, for example, read in Braille. We add about one bit of noise to music CDs. It helps your your inner ear and the brain structure perceive signals. Like if you go to my webpage, you can see an image of a digitized Playboy Playmate, the standard bearer of image processing algorithms, Lena. And you can see as you add more noise to the pixels, Lena becomes clearer. You can see more structure. If you add too much noise, you lose it. So this turns out to be not an exception, but a very common thing in nature, George. A lot of creatures, from sharks to crayfish to rats, we've been able to demonstrate, we being the collective noise community, have evolved to exploit the noise in their background to better detect a predator, for example. If you're a crayfish living on a muddy creek bottom in Mississippi, then your big concern is a fish that could come grab you, or if you're in a lake, it's the largemouth bass. But that largemouth bass has a characteristic wiggle back and forth. It's a sine wave, in effect. And what that means is in the frequency domain, there's a big spike of energy at a certain frequency. So it has evolved over time to detect that spike. And it turns out, because our neural processing is nonlinear, not linear, it turns out that taking advantage of the noise in the water, in effect the turbulence or the turbidity of the water, that actually enhances the ability of the crayfish, the neurons in its tail fin, to detect prey, in this case to detect largemouth bass. We can also conclude from, I'm going to keep pointing my papers on the webpage, but you can look at some of these mathematical papers. I've proven mathematically that a neuron, a simple on-off kind of neuron or approximation, is guaranteed mathematically to benefit from noise in certain conditions. And we are eager to test that now in the flesh. We have not yet done so. But we know mathematically it must happen. So we have an active hypothesis.
I'm still trying to find Lena on your website.
If you go to the second journal paper listed, December of 2004, the journal IEEE Transactions of Neural Networks, Lena
just
will be...
Just assure me, Bart, she doesn't get too clear when we pop it up on the website. We'll be back in a moment. 1 hour to go. Your phone calls with our very special guest tonight, Bart Costco, right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Tonight, tonight, tonight.